Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm so glad you could join me as we talk a little bit about some classic cardboard, and in some cases, some not-so-classic cardboard, but still some fun baseball cards to collect. And we've got a very interesting set that we're looking at this week. And I remember my introduction to this set. I've said this before, but it is so funny how certain details in one's life, you remember like they were yesterday. And at the same time, I can't remember some things I actually did yesterday. It's funny how the brain works. And I remember a card show that I went to here in the Tampa Bay area. This would have been 1990 or 91, you know, somewhere around there. And, you know, it was kind of your average size show at the time. I don't recall where it was. It was in some kind of an exhibition center, though. It wasn't like at the shopping mall. And, it was pretty good size, like 60 or 70 tables. And, you know, again, this is 90 or 91. So, I mean, the hobby is just booming. Everyone's collecting. There's all sorts of things to explore. And me being roughly 13 years old at the time, and not rolling in money, whatever cash I had, probably 10 or 12 bucks, I had already spent at this particular show. And I had a couple of quarters in my pocket. So as I'm walking around table to table, I see one of those baseball card vending machines. And I would love to actually own one. I really would. My wife would kill me if I dropped $1,000 on one of those things. And, you know, rightly so. She would kill me and probably should. But, you know, it's just one of those vending machines. You stick your quarters in, you pop them in there, and then like three cards come out or four cards, depending on the settings for the machine. So here I am down to, if not my last 50 cents, you know, I'm down to the last several coins in my pocket. So I figure, well, why not? And I stick 50 cents into the machine, push the quarters in, out comes a few cards. And two or three of the cards were, you know, common cards. It's what you're typically sticking in those vending machines. So whatever common card from the late 80s I ended up with. But I also ended up with one other card. And I remember looking at it and thinking, well, this is different. It was your average size card, but it wasn't your average card. It was pure white stock. It had a black and white photo of the Duke of Flatbush, Duke Snyder, or Edwin, as his family may have called him. And underneath the photo of Duke striking a batting pose at Dodgertown in Vero Beach, Florida, it has his name, Duke Snyder, and at the bottom it says center fielder, Los Angeles Dodgers. And I went, okay, this is kind of neat. And I flipped the card over, and it had this pretty boring background to it. It had a couple of baseballs stamped on it, some biographical information, and the lower two-thirds of the card had this giant box with a big globe right in the middle of it. And it said, Renata Galasso, Inc., world's largest hobby card dealer, with a street address for Brooklyn, New York, and down at the bottom, 1977 TCMA. Now, I've told you before, I've always had this special connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers, and of course a lot of baseball fans do. We all have this nostalgia for the Brooklyn Dodgers and Ebbets Field. But with my dad growing up in Brooklyn in the 1940s and 50s, I have that special personal connection. You know, I can talk to somebody who's actually been to Ebbets Field, who remembers the joy that was celebrated in the borough in 1955, and who, by pure chance, his favorite player was Duke Snyder. So it was kind of neat. I'm like, oh, here's a Duke Snyder card. But as I'm looking this over, I'm like, wait a minute, who's this Renata Galasso? What is this goofy-looking card in 1977 TCMA? What is this? And I just kind of put it in the bag with the rest of the cards and took them home, and that was that. But a funny thing has happened nearly 30 years later. I still have this card. through all the years of sorting and resorting and donating all the junk wax era cards that I had many years ago, for whatever reason, this odd and somewhat of a letdown of a card that I got when I was a teenager, I hung on to, despite the fact that Duke Snider is not the Duke of Flatbush here. He's the Duke of Rodeo Drive, the Los Angeles Dodgers. How dare you? They were always the Brooklyn Dodgers back home. But I hung on to this card, and I'm glad I did, because recently, at a local card show, the one that you've heard me talk about a lot that I frequented, one of the dealers that I typically buy from, a nice older gentleman who often has some good deals, had this Tupperware bin of cards that were 8 for $1. And some were a little beat up. Some are cards that you may actually consider common nowadays, believe it or not, like 85 tops George Brett or an 84 tops Ricky Henderson, all in near mint condition. So, hey, for 12 cents a piece, why not? And as I'm going through this bin of cards, I find several, in fact, about 20 of these TCMA cards, and I set them aside, and I go to the $3 for $2 bin to get some of the bigger names, such as Satchel Paige and Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams, and for a grand total of about $4, I picked up maybe about half of the 1977 TCMA Renato Galasso set. And we're going to talk about that set, because it is a very unique set. It's a set that was created by a very unique woman, and that alone is unique. We mostly think of baseball card collecting and selling as a guy's hobby, and it is a male-dominated hobby and business these days, but a very business-minded entrepreneurial genius in Renato Galasso put this set together. And we're going to talk to the guy who actually printed the set for her. That would be the MA of TCMA. Mike Ehrenstein will be my guest a little later on in the podcast. And really looking forward to talking to him, because he played a small part in this set in that, again, he helped produce them. And through some family connections, knew Renata and was able to help her out with this project. But also, he had a hand in the not only growth of the hobby, but really the creation of the hobby. Mike was very, very much involved in the early days of the hobby, talking about late 60s, early 70s, when the hobby started shifting to a collector's hobby, not just people, not just kids buying baseball cards, but people hanging on to them, trading them, assessing value to them, and then eventually becoming a big business down the line later on in the 70s and into the 80s, and the rest of the story. So we'll talk about the 1977 TCMA set. We'll also get to some responses about some classic junk wax that our listeners are collecting. This is in response to our previous podcast, which highlighted the 1991 Fleer Ultra set, which I think, thanks to our podcast, is finally getting a little more love than it should. And at the very least, it's a good bargain bin, why not purchase for collectors everywhere. As always, I like to set the table here at the beginning of the podcast to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday, so our next show will be 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, May the 24th, and we're going to be probably bouncing back into some more modern sets from the 80s or 90s. We'll see what we've got in stock, if I can make it out to the next card show, which I believe is next weekend. We'll see what treasures I can find there. But we'll be joining you again via our home base at Audio Boom, also via iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Google Play, and Spotify, and of course all the other platforms that take our RSS feed and send it everywhere. Also, you can talk to us at any time at Wax and Gum Stains. That is our Twitter handle. Right now, actually, we've had a few listeners make some show topic suggestions. I'm always open to that. I do not guarantee that we'll actually go in depth on any particular topic, but we do have some interesting ones, including new sets that feature retired or Hall of Fame players. We've got one collector who thinks it's a bit of a nuisance that you have to get a card from somebody who hasn't played in 30 or 40 years to create a or complete a new set. And I'm kind of with you on that, kind of not, but we'll leave that up to our fans to discuss. Also, a suggestion about talking a little more about minor league sets. We actually did that a while back. I'm trying to remember the episode number. I want to say episode 66, something like that. If you go back in our archives, you'll find that. Touched briefly on it and talked about a few particular minor league sets that really took the run of the show in the late 80s and early 90s, starting with Star Cards and then Pro Cards. And let's see, what did we have after that? Well, after that, then you had like Upper Deck got involved. Who else? I'm forgetting the name. I'm forgetting the name of one of the companies. You know how minor league cards blew up in the early 90s and really took the whole prospect game to a whole new level. Unfortunately for minor league cards, Classic, that was the name of the set. It racked my brain there. Classic had a lot of minor league cards back in the early 90s. Unfortunately for a lot of the smaller fish, Bowman had pretty much taken that crown by the mid-90s as being the set of the rookie card, or in many ways the pre-rookie card, you know, the first card of a player who was still 4 or 5 years away from making the big leagues. And Bowman specialized that, and that eventually helped phase out some of these other sets over the years. But minor league cards are still a big thing. I know Topps has a Topps Heritage minor league set, which I'm not a big fan of, just for some strange reason. Love minor league baseball. Go to a lot of minor league baseball games here in Florida. But, you know, that's just something I haven't gotten back into when looking back at the hobby. But anything you want to talk about, Wax and Gum Stains is the place to do it. So feel free to leave your comments about the show, about the sets we talk about some of the players we talk about. And we will talk about some of the players from the stack of TCMA cards. I did pull four of the, I hate to say lesser known, because, you know, all of these players were, if not Hall of Fame worthy, you know, outstanding all-stars in their day. But when you've got Duke Snider and Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams and Satchel Paige and some of these other really big names, you know, a name like George Kell or Jackie Jensen, you know, may fall between the cracks. Even though they were great ball players, they don't quite measure up to the Mantles and the Mays and the Hank Aarons and all those other players from that time. So we'll talk a little bit about the players from that set later on in this program. But like I said, if you want to talk about players, cards, the hobby in general, post your comments at Wax and Gum Stains at any time. And finally, just a reminder that we appreciate any and all cash donations to Wax Ecstatic via our PayPal account. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's one word, by the way, Wax Ecstatic. paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you have made a donation, we thank you. If you have been sitting on the fence just thinking, well, should I? Yes, you should, actually, because there's a lot of time and energy that goes into this program. But I like to remind our fans that every donation goes right back into the show in one of two ways. One is the maintenance of our main site at Audio Boom, and thus all of our affiliate channels, if you will, the iTunes and the Stitchers and all that. And it also helps maintain the archive. We've been doing the show off and on for about 3 years now, so there's well over 125 episodes. You can go back and listen to any episode about any particular set, primarily from the 1980s on, but we did the whole cycle. We've gone as far back as 49 Bowman, so there's plenty to talk about and listen to So that's where the money goes. So we have to pay that annual fee to keep that going. But also it goes to the purchase of these cards. So we're talking about the TCMA set because of a handful of dollars that were donated by listeners. And, you know, that creates a show. That creates something to talk about. And the more donations we get, the better the product we can get. We can find some vintage wax. We can buy some cards from the 40s and 50s. We can, dive into some of the more unique sets a little easier. We can get those cards in our hands to show and to share. So again, even if it's just $5, if it's 10, if it's 20, if it's more, great. But even if it's just a few dollars, it goes a long, long way. And I will always hold that 89 Bowman Rack Pack over your head. If you don't make your cash donations, I will dedicate an entire show to opening a 89 Bowman Rack Pack. And I don't think anybody wants that. Even me, one of the few staunch defenders of the 89 Bowman set and what Topps / Bowman was trying to do in 1989. So, again, that's my Oral Roberts-esque threat. If you don't kick over a few bucks, you will be punished. It won't be God smiting you. It will be me sharing 89 Bowman with you. So please get those donations in. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. All right, real quickly, before we talk about the TCMA set, want to dive into a couple comments from Wax and Gum Stains, including one of our more recent followers, Not a Wahlberger is his handle, which is awesome. A couple of comments. First says, found your podcast via TF Radio's B. Kilby and listened to your latest podcast. Wow, what a huge nostalgia trip. All 1989 to 99 Focus episodes are in my listening queue. Well, I only go up to about 93, but that's good. Most looking forward to the 89 and 90 Donruss episodes. Well, first, thank you to Brian Kilby and Radio Free Cybertron for making that connection to Not a Wahlberger. I'm so glad that we're able to pull you in here. Interesting sets that you talk about there, 89 and 90 Donruss. Again, through our archives, you can go back and listen to those. That may be, I certainly wouldn't put it to the head of the stack, but especially the 89 Donruss, that may be one we kind of revisit at some point in time. 90 Donruss, meh. 89 Donruss, however, doesn't quite get the credit it's due. It's a really nice set and very affordable because it's right in the heart of the junk wax era. But if you like a nice, colorful set, front and back, good photography, good star power, some pretty good rookies in there as well. Kurt Schilling is one of them. You've got some young star cards for John Smoltz, Tom Glavin, Roberto Alomar, Ken Griffey Jr., of course. I mean, you've got some pretty good star power in that set, too. So that may be a fun one that, again, we revisit somewhere down the line. Now, Not a Wahlberger also adds, in response to our 91 Fleer Upper Deck, or 91 Fleer Ultra, in an attempt to be like Upper Deck, he thought. 91 Fleer Ultra podcast from a couple weeks ago. He sends a picture of three boxes of 92 Topps Stadium Club. And in fact, it's a box each of series 1, 2, and 3. Now, I've often criticized 91 Score for being the poster child of the bloated baseball card hobby. Topps Stadium Club was starting to encroach on Score's territory in 1992. Yeah, they had three series of cards. And I think it was almost 900 cards when you add them all up there. But anyways, he's got three boxes from the 92 Stadium Club set. And he says, I was relegated to Donruss Tops and Upper Deck if I saved in 92 due to meager allowance at the time. This set was always out of reach, but now it's less than a case of beer. See, that's a good barometer. How many cases of beer is this comparable to? If you can basically put together a 92 Top Stadium Club set for the price of a case of Bud Light, that's a pretty good value. He continues, If this is fun, I'll try other junk wax sets. Thanks for the nostalgia. Well, you're welcome. And it is fun. And I think that's, you know, a lot of the times when we're collecting cards, we are so wrapped up in the idea of how much is this worth? And a little less in the what kind of bang am I getting for my buck? And I think there is value in just opening up a box of cards for the sake of it. And even if you don't want to keep them, I've mentioned these, you know, again, they're not really charities, not officially, but these nonprofit organizations, if you will, Kidority Cards and Cards for Kids. All of these cards, you know, if you buy four or five junk wax boxes and you go through them and, you know, you pull out a set or you keep a few star cards, you know, donate these cards. These groups will find something to do with them. And put them to good use and keep kids, young kids, you know, involved in the hobby, mixing some of these older cards from the 80s and 90s with more contemporary cards. So there's nothing wrong with going to a card show or your local card dealer and getting a box of 92 Stadium Club for what? Probably $8? Probably paid that. You know, we've opened up the 92 Topps box. That was $7. We've opened up the 91 Fleer Ultra box, the 92 Upper Deck box. They came out to, what, like $6 or $7 a piece. I mean, it's just cheap fun. you spend an hour opening them up. Maybe you spend an hour organizing them if you decide, well, it's worth the time and effort to collate a set together. You know, there's nothing bad here. So enjoy that. Go ahead and, you know, spend those extra dollars, have a little fun opening up some quote unquote junk wax, because when you're looking at bang for the buck, I mean, a box of cards for $5, $6, $7, you can't beat it. And as I always say, nothing makes a card dealer happier than helping them unload some 80s and 90s junk wax. That's why they're pricing it as low as $5 or $6. In the long run, they're losing money on this, but they're just so damn glad to get it out of their house. Heard from Brendan Abels when we took Not a Wahlburgers comment and shared it, said, are there any sets that you're chasing right now? Brendan says, currently chasing 92 OPG baseball because I love the sharp photography and quality of the cardstock. Some interesting points you bring up there, Brendan. OPG baseball gets a knock because it was released in Canada. It is bilingual, which is neat. So you have English and French on there. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes the OPG sets were slightly different than the Topps sets because we have, let's see, I think some shorter runs on a few of these, or, you know, Topps would have a 792 card set 1 year, and OPG, they would run only 660. Again, it didn't always happen, but I know sometimes there were some variations between Topps and OPG. But one thing that I did like about the OPG cards were the points that you brought up, because of the cardstock quality. The photography was better. Just the whole design of the card seemed to pop a little better than the gray cardstock that Topps was printed on. And as somebody who actually, you know, liked learning French, and I actually learned French in high school and continued it in college, I thought it was kind of neat to have bilingual cards. Now, maybe I didn't understand what was on half of the cards there, but it was kind of neat that you had the mix of the two. So that's very interesting. And it's funny too, you know, in baseball cards, Topps is the big one and OPG was kind of the, you know, neat alternative. But in hockey cards, it's the other way around. Of course, OPG being the big brand in Canada, you would go after the OPG cards because they were more valuable, and the top set was kind of the neat alternative, certainly the cheaper of the two. Mike Smith also responding to our commentary, chasing, this is an interesting combo of sets here, 78 and 91 Topps. I know a lot of collectors over the last few years have come around to 91 Topps and have really really put their hands around that set. I've always liked 91 Tops, even when it came out. I always loved it. I call it the last classic card set because in 92, everybody, you know, kind of went to a premium design and the prices went up. And as everyone's chasing Upper Deck and all the premium sub-brands that came out. But 91 Tops is and always will be a classic. It also helps that that was the year that Topps was celebrating their 55th anniversary. So you had, the 40th anniversary. No, 55th was not that long ago. The 40th anniversary. So you had the card inserts, the classic card inserts. You had this kind of fun little chase going on there. And then 78 Topps, too. While it is certainly not as plentiful as 91 Topps, it is very affordable. It's one of those sets that kind of borders on the vintage era, which some people kind of mark off as 73 and back, and then the junk wax era, which depending on who you ask, it's either started around 87 or 88, or some people go back to the early 80s. So 78 Topps kind of straddles those two eras of baseball cards. But talk about a classic. Scrappy is the word that I use. It is just a fun, simple design. And of course, the unique colors on the back, the play ball game as well. So that's an interesting set that you're chasing, interesting pair of sets that you're trying to put together there, Mike. So again, thanks to everybody who commented at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, let's take a look at this 1977 TCMA Renata Galasso set. And again, Mike Ehrenstein, the MA of TCMA, will be joining me in just a few minutes. You'll hear our phone conversation in just a bit. Going back to the early 70s, Mike Ehrenstein partnered up with the late Tom Collier. And that is where the TC of TCMA comes in. They formed TCMA Cards. And as I mentioned, in the mid-70s, not only were they big in turning the hobby-slash-collecting business of baseball cards into a business, they were big in creating minor league cards, big in creating their own Major League Baseball cards, not only featuring past players, but current players, got them in trouble with Topps in the mid-70s. We talked about the SSPC sets in the past and how unique of a set and somewhat of a challenge it was to Topps in the mid-70s. As I've mentioned before, the SSPC set really wasn't the big domino that created the open market of baseball cards starting in 1981. It was a very long, drawn-out lawsuit from the Fleer Corporation that really got that going. But TCMA in the mid-70s created or produced, they didn't create it, they produced this set for a young lady named Renata Galasso. And in full transparency here, I tried to track down Renata Galasso. She is still, by all accounts, alive and well, still living in New York. I could not do it. I reached out to a few of our well-connected listeners. They couldn't connect me to her either, which is unfortunate. If we do find a way to connect with Renata, I would love to talk to her about these sets and her business. But she has such an interesting story. Basically, in the early 1970s, Renata, along with her husband, decided to collect baseball cards and sell them. And she opened up one of the first baseball card stores. And it's the store that's referred to on the back of these cards, the Renata Galasso Incorporated, or again, the tagline here, world's largest hobby card dealer. Now, if she was legitimately the world's largest, that's another argument, but certainly she was one of the first. And according to several stories that I've read about her, one big reason why she started this business was to pay for her college tuition. So a very smart business lady. And I have mentioned before that it's not all that unusual to hear of women being heavily involved in the card industry back in the 70s in particular. We think of it mostly as a male hobby, and it is certainly male dominated. There are women who do still partake in the business, and I've done business with them, recently. But she was one of the people who helped lay the foundation to what the card collecting industry is these days, the way that we understand the hobby nowadays. She was one of many people, along with Mike Ehrenstein, who helped really lay that foundation over 40 years ago. So she's doing this not only because she likes baseball and she's collecting baseball cards and living in New York in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, the fun Mets coming around, that sparked a whole new collecting group, people who like National League baseball and the young, fun, up-and-coming Mets. Of course, you have the Yankees in town, too. And it helped reignite the collecting passions for former Giants and Dodgers fans after the teams moved out to California. So Renata and her husband, they open up this business, and she has a very unique way of selling these cards. It's not like she just got wax packs from Tops and sold them. She would buy cases and cases and cases of these cards, open up the packs, hand collate these sets, and then she would run these full-page advertisements. Perhaps you remember them if you're old enough, in the Sporting News or other, as collector magazines came around in the 80s, you would see her advertisements there. But these full-page advertisements, buy through Renata Galasso, I've got the latest, 1975 Topps set. And to help entice people to buy a hand-collated set from her, she would include some exclusive bonus cards. And starting in 1977, with the help of Mike Ehrenstein, Tom Collier, and the TCMA company, Renata Galasso produced these sets of cards featuring mostly Hall of Fame or classic baseball players. And looking through this stack, and again, we posted a video link yesterday on Wax and Gum Stands. I showed off some of these. But let me just go just from the top of the stack to the bottom. Let me share some of these cards here. We've got Duke Snider, which is the one that I told you about that I got many, many years ago. George Kell, Bob Feller, Richie Ashburn, Casey Stengel, Billy Pierce, Luis Aparicio, Al Rosen, Early Wynn, Eno Slaughter, Don Larson, picture with the Baltimore Orioles, by the way, Robin Roberts, Smokey Burgess, Al Lopez, Jackie Jensen, Don Newcomb, Bobby Thompson, Allie Reynolds, let's see, who else we got here? Lou Boudreau, and then some of the bigger names, some of the more valuable cards, Jackie Robinson, Satchel Paige, Roberto Clemente, Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, and Hank Aaron. So these are some pretty big names here. Even the names that maybe don't stand out to you, these were some absolute star players of the 1950s and 60s. And thanks to Mike Ehrenstein and his vast photography collection, he owned the rights to a lot of negatives of ballpark pictures that were taken in the 40s and 50s and 60s. They created these beautiful, good card stock, great photograph, star cards of these Hall of Famers, these dominant kings of the golden era of baseball, post-World War II in most cases. And even though the design of the card was very simple, very minimalist, it lets the photography do all the work. And there is something about black and white photography that when the photograph is just right, whether it's a ball player, whether it's a city scene, whether it's kids running around on the playground, whatever the subject of the photograph is, there is something about a perfectly produced black and white photograph the contrast, the sharpness. We talk about the black and the white, but the grays, there's subtle differences in the tones of the gray. There is a character to black and white photography that color photography doesn't quite have. And I think our generation today, because, you know, color photography, whether it be film or pictures, has been around really since the 20s and 30s. Color television's actually been around since the 30s, but really wasn't in everybody's home until the late 60s and early 70s. So if you're, you know, 45 or 50 years or younger, you've pretty much grown up in an entirely colorized world. And it's funny how, you know, if you look at black and white photos, you think that the world was black and white, which of course it wasn't. But, you know, you're flooded with black and white images and it's hard to put the color to them. But because we've grown up in an age of color photography and high definition, you sometimes just need the simplicity of black and white photography or film, as the case may be, to see this difference and appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the Twilight Zone, the original Rod Serling Twilight Zone. Now, I know there's a new Twilight Zone out there. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. It's had some great reviews. But one of the big things that made the original Twilight Zone so special was the black and white film. And even though some episodes were recorded on videotape and were really well written, well acted, well produced, you know, the quality of the videotape is not quite the same as the film. So there's an appreciation for black and white that I have that I think if you've grown up, again, if you're 50 or under, you know, the chances are you've had all color everything in your life. Maybe you had a black and white TV in your house when you were young, but it was the second TV, you know, it was in your parents' bedroom. I think if you take a closer look at some of these black and white photographs, you really, really appreciate the artwork in the simplicity of the contrast of black and white and all the various grays in between. And I think that's something where, as I'm going through this box of cards that are being sold $8 for a dollar, and I'm just pulling all these cards out. Granted, they're all in great shape. These are near mint condition cards. But, you know, you're looking at these photographs and you're thinking, wow, this is a very simple yet sharp production here. And the first set of Renata Galasso cards in 1977, 45 cards featuring stars of the 1950s and 60s, that was the bonus set. If you purchased a set of cards, primarily 1977 tops, but I would imagine it was, you know, applicable to all the other sets that she was selling at the time. And that was your bonus. A special thank you for spending the $8 or $10, however much you spent on the set. Here's an extra exclusive set of 45 cards of Hall of Famers, or soon to be Hall of Famers, as the case may have been, in 1977. And we thank you for your business. Now, collecting full sets, that was also a novelty at the time. Topps did not release a complete one-series set until 1974, and that was the same year that the Topps set was sold as one unit through, I believe, Sears, maybe it was JCPenney, anyways, through catalog sales. Before, you collected the individual cards through series and made your own sets. So having somebody assemble a set for you and you buy the whole set, as opposed to buying pack upon pack upon pack and making it yourself, was very unusual. But it was a great business driver for Renata Galasso, because once you sold an entire set to somebody and they could go picking through it, then they may go, hey, I want some extra, you know, Willie Mays cards, or, you know, in the case of 77 tops, hey, I want some extra Pete Rose cards, or this young kid, this Robin Yount, this Paul Molitor, this George Brett, you know, I want these guys. So then you would go out and buy packs or boxes or maybe the single cards, and you kept the business coming. So it was a very smart business move by Renata, and a very, very nice set. And one real quick funny note here, And I didn't notice this until recently. But as I'm looking through these cards, so I pick up the Mickey Mantle card, and it's a great shot of Mantle. He is striking a batter's pose. He's not in Yankee Stadium. I'm looking at this, and I want to say it might be Shy Park. Could be Ebbets Field. Might be from a World Series. Could be, I don't think it's Tiger Stadium. I think it's either Shy Park or Ebbets Field. But great shot of him pregame, striking a batting pose. The young, healthy, vibrant Mickey Mantle. And I flip the card over and I realize, Mickey Mantle, what do you know? Card number 7. Well, of course, being in New York, Renato Galasso, you're going to tip the cap to the Mick. Let's give him card number 7. And here's the bio on the back of card number 7. The greatest switch hitter of all time. Mickey won the MVP 3 times, in 1956 when he won the Triple Crown, in 1957, and again in 1962, exclamation point. His 536 lifetime home runs place him 6th on the all-time list. Mickey holds many World Series records. Home runs with 18, runs scored 42, and RBIs 40, elected to the Hall of Fame in 1974. So that is the gospel of Mickey Mantle. And I thought, you know, I wonder, you know, if the Mick is on card number 7, then surely Ted Williams has to be card number 9, right? No. This is how you know Renato was a true blue New Yorker and probably a Yankee fan. Ted Williams is on card number 10. So he's just one off from 9. And here's the bio on the Williams card. The splendid splinter may be the greatest all-around hitter that ever played the game. Meh, maybe. He was the last player to hit over 400, batting 406 in 1941. He led the American League in home runs 4 times, won 6 batting titles, finished with 521 home runs, and a .344 average. He even tried his hand at pitching for the Red Sox in 1940. Was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1966. So some interesting stats, some impressive stats, but not quite as glorified as number 7, Mickey Mantle. I don't know if that was by choice or accidental, but seeing that Hank Aaron has card number 44 tells me there was probably some premeditated acts of Red Sox hatred going on there. By the way, George Kell, the third baseman, longtime third baseman for the Boston Red Sox, with card number 9. The Renato Galasso sets via TCMA would continue through 1983. In the 1978 season, it featured players from, I believe, the 1930s and 40s, following year, 1910s and 20s, and she would continue to produce card sets of 45 cards each for Hall of Famers or soon-to-be Hall of Famers or some really outstanding players throughout her history. Now, like I said, I tried to track down Renata. I could not find her, unfortunately, or at least I could not connect her. But, you know, hopefully we do cross paths at some point in time. If not, that's okay. But one of the beauties of the TCMA set, other than just the simplistic design, and it makes for a great autograph card, it is incredibly affordable. Now, if you buy these and you get them in good condition, they are worth, depending on the player, you know, again, the Mantles and the Clementes and the Williams and the Aarons, those are the ones that you could probably get $2 or $3 for. If you do want to go through the grading process, however, I have seen some of the big star cards at a PSA 9 or PSA 10 going for $30 or $40. So this could be one of those bargain bin finds if you find the right collector who kept these in really good condition and you go through the trouble of going through a grading process. You could, in the end, have a very valuable set featuring some great players over the history of baseball. But even if you don't want to go through the trouble of grading and trying to make these bargain bin finds, $30 and $40 cards, you can still basically assemble an entire set, or some people sell the entire set for just a few dollars. And I mean a few dollars. Some people will get rid of these for $4, $5, or $6. So keep that in mind. If you're looking for a bargain and a very unique set from a very unique person, then take a look at the TCMA Renata Galasso cards, starting in 1977 and distributed throughout the early 1980s. They might be a pleasant find and a pleasant surprise for you. Now, a pleasant surprise for me was tracking down our guest. While I was trying to get a hold of Renata Galasso, I discovered an email address for Mike Ehrenstein. And we traded emails, traded phone calls, and I was able to speak to him a few days ago. And Mike talked about his start in the hobby, not just as a collector, but as a business person, how he and Renata Galasso crossed paths to create this and several other sets in the late 70s and early 80s. And what is he doing nowadays? Is he still collecting? And if he is, what's the one thing that's really bothering him about sports cards these days? So here's my conversation with Mike Ehrenstein, co-founder of TCMA. Thank you so much for joining us on Wax Ecstatic, Mike. I'm really glad that you could join us for a few minutes today.
Glad to be with you.
So, Mike, let's inform those who don't know who you are. What got you into the hobby? I know that it starts like many of us in our childhood, but how did you get involved in the hobby of collecting baseball cards, and how did you have that evolve into a business throughout the 1970s, for starters?
I've been asked this question before, and I can remember when I was 7 years old in 1947 going into a candy store and buying a strip of baseball cards for a penny. And that got me started. And I kind of started when baseball cards started over again after the war. So I've been collecting ever since. And one of my classic tales is 51 Bowman. They were a nickel a pack, so a box was $1.20, and that was too expensive for an 11-year-old. So I went to the wholesaler, and I asked him if I could buy a box, and he looked at me like, "You're a little kid." He said, "Okay, 85 cents. So 51 Bowmans, 24 packs for 85 cents. Wish I had them today.
Yeah, in certain lower conditions, you can get them at that price. But so you learned the value of a budget pretty early on there. Did you continue to amass your personal collection that way by just cutting out the middleman, or is this just a one-off that just kind of got you started?
No, I did that for years and years. And then eventually it got me into business. What really started me is when I was spending so much money on my hobby, and my uncle was a cartoonist, and he drew a card set for me, and we advertised it in the sporting news, and it sold very well, and that really got me started.
So when you got started, for our listeners who don't know about card collecting and then the growth of the business, say, in the 1970s, what really, so the advertisement gets you going, but what was the marketplace like? Because a lot of us, if you grew up in the 80s or 90s, there were card shops everywhere, there were baseball cards everywhere. It was business first, hobby second in a lot of cases. But what was the scene like, especially in New York City where you grew up, during the, for a lack of a better term, the innocent days of baseball card collecting?
Actually, we were the first ones to put on a show, not even a show. We invited collectors to my house, and we traded. And then after that, we started to do shows. But shows were the big thing. There were no stores, and of course, there was no internet. So we would do mailings. we had a mailing list of over 100,000 collectors, and we would do that four times a year. And that's really the only choice that people had, was to do with mail order.
Mike Ehrenstein joining us on Wax Ecstatic. Mike, when you look back at those early days, like you said, it starts with mail order collections. Did it seem odd? Did some people go, wait a minute, you're going to sell me baseball cards? Why would I want to buy baseball cards from you? Why I can go to the store and buy baseball cards? Or why would I want a baseball card from 1951? It's 1971, for crying out loud. Why do I want to do that? Was there any resistance early on?
No. The collectors identified with it totally. When I started to produce cards, I produced them of living players from the 30s so people could get autographs. The guys used to send just postcards to the players. And I'm the one who started to provide them with little photos of the players. That, you know, and everyone just loved it.
For the most part, this was before the days where Bob Feller figured out you could charge for an autograph. So some players were a little more accessible. So this was part of the secret to the success, too, not just offering a product that was in demand, not only getting it at a good price, but if you were an autograph seeker and you happened to know how to get in contact with one of these Hall of Famers, then your particular cards, that was an easy get for somebody. Well, why wouldn't I want a stack of these when I can track down Joe DiMaggio or Al Lopez or whomever?
Right, and the only cost would be a stamp. Well, two stamps to get them back. One stamp to send it and one stamp to get it back.
Yeah, and it wasn't machine printed either. It was actually a hand autograph, which is great. Let's, real quickly, the New York baseball scene too. And I've read how even though you lived close to Yankee Stadium, you grew up a Giants fan, the Giants and Dodgers go out west. So you have this revival when the Mets come back, or when the Mets start, I should say. National League Baseball is back. The baseball scene in New York City, at the same time that this business venture is opening up here, how did one play off the other for you?
It was vibrant. I mean, Mets fans, Yankee fans, it's amazing how knowledgeable they are and how what they know about history and what they understand about the game. It's just tremendous. The market in New York was, you know, just huge. And the fans loved the teams. I mean, a Giants fan would never talk to a Dodgers fan. Only kidding. But it was just beautiful. It was just a great time.
And I recall my mother told me the story. She grew up in Long Island. She was a teenager in the early 60s when the Mets came about. And she collected baseball cards, too, in the pre-internet days and before everybody had books or websites about advanced stats. The best way to get to know about a baseball player was to collect the cards. All the stats you needed were on the back, the picture, the uniform, the team logo. It was all on there. So women collecting baseball cards was not all that unusual. It sounds unusual now because it's mostly a male-dominated hobby and business. But, you know, women would collect, and especially in a big metropolitan area like New York. And that brings me to Renata Galasso, who was also a business person in the early to mid-70s. Now, by this point in time, by 77, you'd already created your own line of Major League Baseball cards. Your Hall of Fame editions, if you will, like you said, to send out and get autographed. You started the minor league baseball card in the mid-1970s. How did Renata Galasso, how did you two connect, and how did the first of her series of historical baseball cards come to be in the late 70s?
Okay. Renata's husband was Bill Hongosh. And when I started the business, he was a teenager. And we had been friends for a long time, and he ended up as the Yankees' bat boy. So him and I were close, and that's how they asked me to do the cards for them. And I had all the photographs. It's an archive that I had purchased. I had thousands of the players from the early 20th century. And if you look at the card sets, a lot of the photo, well, I think the original set was all players from the 1910s, the 1920s, you know, really early days, and beautiful photos.
And is there truth to the rumor that she started the business? She would hand collate sets and include, yes, these bonus sets, if you will, the Hall of Fame sets, as part of the purchase. But is there truth to the rumor that she kind of got this business going to help pay off college, pay off some debt that way?
It sounds right, but I'm not sure. It's funny. I met Bill Hondash about a year ago at a card show.
Wow.
I hadn't seen him in like 30 years. It was amazing.
Ah, such a small world, who you bump, yeah, into there. Mike Arenstein joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. And again, we appreciate you taking the time out and doing this. So, like I said, the Renata Galasso cards that TCMA printed for her, this was part of a bonus ad. If you purchased a hand-collated set from her in the mid to late 70s, you got this bonus set of cards thrown in here. What was the collector reaction to this type of set? Because like I said, you've been producing a lot of cards at this point in time, but was there anything different or special about the reception that was received about these particular cards?
Not that I can recall. I know they did tremendously well with them. They, you know, the collectors just seem to love them. You know, they, when was that? That was in the late 70s, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. All I know is I produced it for them, and, you know, they ordered them, and I sent it to them.
You had a good business deal going, because they were sets that evolved. You know, there were six or seven more sets that came out of it. Have you heard, you know, you mentioned that you're still collecting now, and you're at shows. Do you see them pop up every now and then, or do you see any other TCMA cards? You go, yep, I made that one, and that one, and that one. Is it amazing all these years later how they are still an integral part of the hobby?
Yeah, I was at the Chicago show last year, the National, and I was in a booth, and I told the guy that I was MA from TCMA, and I thought he was going to faint.
Did you have to produce ID too, or he was just floored?
He was amazed. He said, "Oh, I've been waiting to meet you for 40 years." Oh my god.
Oh, so people still recognize, and they go, "Oh, you're the MA part of it," and I'm sure that they regale you with stories of collecting the cards too. Since you still collect, what's the biggest change in the hobby? I'm sure I could guess at this answer, but you know, what's the one thing that keeps you coming back? But what's the one thing that keeps people away?
I think making false rarity, it, to me, is the, you know, they're making the cards rare as they print them, which, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, they would just produce a card set and you tried to put it together. You know, it wasn't the gold edition, you know, the blue, the red, the green, you know, it was just one set. And it was just easier to collect.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that from a lot of collectors, and one reason why a lot of collectors left in the 80s or 90s, or some are still hesitant to get back in today, is that even though there's only one, at least in baseball cards, there's one major officially licensed product, it's Topps. There's so many brands underneath that Topps umbrella, and then like you said, there's so many versions and different versions of versions that make it a little bit of a headache now. But it's still a fun thing for you to go out, maybe you're not buying the new products, but just to go out and add to the collection all these years later.
Yeah, well, what I collect now is every single Met. I'm trying to get a card of every Met from 62 on.
And how's that collection coming so far?
I think I have about 3/4 of them. And if anybody wants to trade, I have about 5,000 cards to trade.
So if anyone wants to trade so that you're not inundated, DM Wax Ecstatic, and if you're okay with it, I'll send you the occasional email or two. Are there any particular years or players that are giving you tough times?
No, I think, the 80s and 90s, I have just about everybody.
Yeah, you probably have 10 copies of each one, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The later ones and the earlier ones. But it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, that's...
And I just do it, you know, just to have fun.
That's excellent. And lastly, Mike, and again, thank you for the time here today. Your family is still involved in sports and not just cards, but photography, too. How has your love for the game and for collecting spread around the Arenstein family recently?
Well, my son still works for Photophile, and he curated their archive, which is immense. And he's also customer service for Photophile. And what I've been doing also, this is my payback, is I take pictures of every guy in the Pecos League, and I give them pictures of themselves. And so I've been having just a ball doing that.
That is excellent.
It's just a lot of fun. And the Pecos League is a lot of fun. And it's an independent league in New Mexico. So I enjoy that immensely.
Yeah, you're dealing with some up-and-coming talent, but you're also dealing with some interesting characters, I would imagine, that's playing in that league.
Yeah.
Got to be fun to track those down. And I'm sure there's purely... original photography, there's nothing, no sombreros, nothing goofy showing up in any of these pictures, correct?
No, it's all action shots.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I hope they're not wearing sombreros in action. That would be a bizarre game. Absolutely. Well, Mike, thank you so much for sharing some time with us, opening the door. For those who don't recall or who weren't around, to know some of the early days of the hobby, and in particular, this Renata Galasso set that we're looking at. And let's keep in touch, because you've had, TCMA had such a big impact on the hobby then and still does now. And I would love to pick your brain more on a few other sets and some other things that have changed in the hobby over the years. So thank you again for joining us on Wax Ecstatic, and good luck with everything in the Pecos League and tracking down every Mets player since 62.
Well, thanks a million. Take care.
All right, my thanks to Mike Arenstein, co-founder of TCMA, for joining us on Wax Ecstatic. And you heard him. He's looking for every single Mets card created since 1962. That is quite an endeavor. And while he's overwhelmed with cards from the 80s and 90s and today, if you have a collection of Mets cards, I don't know if he's particular about condition, but if you have a collection of Mets cards from the 60s and 70s, then perhaps you can help Mike assemble this collection of his. So if you do have some Mets cards that you are willing to offer up to him, please DM me on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, and I will email him with any offers and let you work with him on any kind of deals that you're able to put together. Now, I did pull out a few cards from this TCMA set, and I want to talk about a few of these players because, you know, there's a lot of Hall of Fame players here, a lot of well-known players, but some who may have slipped through the cracks of time. And one of them is Al Rosen, pictured here with the Cleveland Indians. Al Rosen was nicknamed the Hebrew Hammer. So was Hank Greenberg, but I think after Greenberg retired in the mid-40s, Al Rosen gladly took this title. A career 285 hitter with 192 home runs, played his entire career with the Indians from 1947 to 1956. A four-time All-Star, World Series champion in 1948, and your American League MVP in 1953. Now, following his time in baseball as a player, he was a very successful stockbroker, but came back to baseball as an executive. He held some senior positions, first with the New York Yankees, and then later with the Houston Astros. And he was also one of the toughest outs to get as a player, a very underrated player, often overlooked because you had so many other big-name players as the Cleveland Indians had their glory days in the late 40s and early 50s. But as I said, he became the president and CEO of the Yankees in 1978, later president and CEO of the Astros in the early 80s, and he was also the president and general manager of the Giants from 1985 to 1992. Very successful in all three endeavors. Of course, the Yankees won the World Series in 1978. The Astros, National League West champions in 1980, had to go through a little bit of a rebuild in the early 80s, but would become division champions again in 1986. Of course, by then he had moved on to San Francisco, where he helped resuscitate the Giants from a basement-dwelling team into a National League West division champion in 1989 and a contender for several years around then. So he was very, very proud of his Jewish heritage. He had to deal with a lot of ethnic hatred during the 1940s and 50s, not only from fans, but from some players on other teams. He could get very hot-headed when dealing with this diversity, very proud of his heritage. Also, one of the many Jewish players, very similar to Sandy Koufax, who would not play on high holy days. So there were some days where he would sit out due to the Jewish calendar, and he was very, very proud of that heritage. And while some people thought maybe he shied away from it, he has actually said in some interviews that he wished that he had a more Jewish name than Rosen. He was just so proud of that heritage, which is absolutely awesome. Now, he did pass away in March of 2015 in Rancho Mirage, California, at the age of 91 years old. So Al Rosen, often overlooked, but you read any commentary, especially from the Yankees, he was a tough out, a tough cookie to deal with in the first place, and had to go through a lot of adversity and tough times because of his Jewish heritage. And again, not just fans, but players too. And he would challenge people to fight on the field if some kind of epithet was thrown his way. So good on Al Rosen for standing his ground in those cases. Now, speaking of a bit of an adversary to the New York Yankees, I introduced to you Billy Pierce. This is one of the great pitchers who, unfortunately, time has kind of moved on from. And it's not because he was a bad pitcher. In fact, he won 211 games, a 3.27 earned run average, and was just one strikeout shy of 2,000, believe it or not. He was a dominant southpaw, and I think part of the reason why he often gets overlooked nowadays is because he wasn't playing for the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Red Sox. He was playing for the Chicago White Sox. And even though he was part of the Go-Go Sox of 1959, the team that won the American League pennant and then would lose to the Dodgers in the World Series, even though he was part of the contending White Sox teams of the 1950s, he has kind of fallen through the cracks of time, which is unfortunate. He was a seven-time All-Star, won the World Series with Detroit in 1945, even though he didn't play a lot with the Tigers back then. He was your American League wins leader in 1957, your American League strikeout leader in 1953, your Major League ERA leader in 1955. And his number 19 has been retired by the Chicago White Sox, and there is also a statue of him outside of the White Sox ballpark that was unveiled back in 2007. He ranks 10th among left-handers in career wins, 6th in games started, and 6th in games pitched, 8th in shutouts, 9th in innings pitched, and he holds the White Sox franchise record for career strikeouts and his club marks of 186 wins, 2,931 innings, and 390 starts are still team records for the White Sox. Now, one thing that didn't help his cause, too, because the White Sox were the Go-Go Sox, a small ball team, to put it nicely. And, of course, the old Comiskey Park in the 1950s was cavernous. I think it was 440 feet to center field. This is way before they brought the fences in and installed an exploding scoreboards here with Bill Veeck, the mastermind of that. This was a team that you had a lot of hard ground ball hitters, and they could put it in the outfield, but you had speed. You had Luis Aparicio. You had Minnie Mignoso. You had a lot of guys who, on that hard, hard, hard dirt surface of Comiskey Park, and with that expansive outfield, would go station to station. You didn't know the White Sox for slugging power. They were station to station. They had good pitchers, and that's how they contended for many, many years. But one thing that didn't help him was, because of that lack of offensive power, there were some very close games that he lost, even though still in the end in his career, he had 211 wins. Now, he was a pest for the Yankees. There were a lot of head-to-head battles with Whitey Ford, and that was one of the most heralded pitching matchups in the 1950s. Again, often forgotten and overlooked nowadays. But the White Sox and the Yankees had a rivalry. The White Sox often finished second to the Yankees in that rivalry. But Billy Pierce was one of the big reasons why the White Sox were contenders and a thorn in the side of the Bronx Bombers for many, many years. Now, after his time in Chicago, he moved on to San Francisco, started as a starter, and then moved on to really a reliever, and wound down his career with the Giants in 1964, was a key part to the Giants not only defeating the Dodgers in a tiebreaker in 1962, but getting the Giants to the World Series against the New York Yankees. And yes, the Yankees did win that series. So once again, Billy Pierce coming up just short to the Yankees throughout his career. Now, he was highly sought after by teams after his playing career as a coach or a potential manager. But after his playing career, he actually got into broadcasting. He was a color analyst for the White Sox in 1970, was also a partner in car dealerships, a stockbroker, and eventually worked as a sales and public relations representative for the Continental Envelope Company. He worked there for 25 years before his retirement, or 23 years before his retirement in 1997. He was also a scout for the White Sox for many years, and he is credited for discovering the kitty cat, Ron Kittle. So there's Billy Pierce, gone but not forgotten, died at the age of 88 in July of 2015. A couple other players from this set. George Kell, as I mentioned, the third baseman for the Boston Red Sox, who has card number 9 as opposed to Ted Williams. Now, Kell played for many teams in his career, started out with the Philadelphia Athletics, spent a bulk of his career with the Detroit Tigers, but got a lot of attention with Boston in the early 50s, later the White Sox and the Baltimore Orioles, and he would become a longtime broadcaster for the Detroit Tigers. He did play-by-play on television. You know, Ernie Harwell is normally tied together to the Tigers from, you know, basically the 1950s on, but George Kell was the face and voice of the Detroit Tigers for many, many, many years. And, you know, TV didn't really take precedence in broadcasting and baseball until, I want to say, probably the late 60s, early 70s. You know, radio was still king with baseball for many years. But not only was he a longtime broadcaster for the Tigers, but he did a lot of World Series calls with NBC Radio and also some television calls as well, especially if the Tigers were in the World Series, which is often the case in the late 1960s, then you would see Kell doing the call there. Also, he would be teamed up with Al Kaline. Kaline was his color commentator, and they would be on television broadcast for many, many years, starting in the 1970s. Now, as for his playing career, like I said, he played for several teams, but he finishes his career with 2,054 hits, 306 batting average, 10-time All-Star, and your American League batting champion in 1949. Kell has had his number retired by the Detroit Tigers back in 2000 when they moved into Comerica Park. He was also inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame via the Veterans Committee in 1983 and just capped off an outstanding career. And one other interesting note here about George Kell, actually two notes. First of all, the batting title he won in 1949 actually outpaced teammate Ted Williams and prevented the Splendid Splinter from winning his third Triple Crown, as Kell took over the batting title late in the 1949 season. Now, of course, then he was with Detroit. He wasn't with Boston, so I should clarify that. But also one other interesting note, Kell finishing up his career with the Baltimore Orioles in 1956 and 57, as he would hand off the baton to fellow Arkansan, a guy named Brooks Robinson, as Brooksy would hold down the hot corner in Baltimore for a good 20 years afterwards. After his playing career, like I said, he had a long broadcasting career. He also served 10 years on the Arkansas State Highway Commission, believe it or not. And also, he passed away in 2009 at the age of 86. And lastly, I pulled out the card of Jackie Jensen, another great member of the Red Sox teams in the 1950s, also known for his power with the Yankees. That's who he broke in with in 1950, played briefly with the Washington Senators in 52 and 53, and then was property of the Red Sox throughout the 1950s. A three-time All-Star, World Series champion in 1950 with the Yankees. Your American League MVP in 1958, a Gold Glove winner in 1959. He was the odd man out in the ever-changing Yankee outfield in the early 50s. That's why he was expendable, moved to Washington, and then later snapped up by the Red Sox. He was a three-time American League RBI leader, and also has been inducted into the Boston Red Sox Hall of Fame. Now, what's interesting about Jackie Jensen's career is how it unfortunately ended. Jackie Jensen was scared to death to get on an airplane. He had a tremendously wicked fear of flying. And with the Giants and Dodgers moving out to California, and of course, before that, you had the A's relocating to Kansas City, the Braves going to Milwaukee. You were having expansion in the early 1960s, you know, with another team in California, and, you know, the Houston Colt 45s coming around. As baseball shifts west, well, that pretty much ended the days of train travel. You had to go by airplane to many of the cities. And he just couldn't do it. And even though he had an opportunity to play out west, he just did not want to be apart from his family, but he also did not want to fly. And even though he went through psychotherapy and, you know, the Red Sox, you know, tried everything they could to get him to do it, he just did not want to you know, get on the airplanes. And again, coupled with the anxiety of not being able to be with his family for many, many years, he basically left baseball in 1961 because of all of these issues here. Now, after his retirement, he became the sports director at KTVN Radio in Reno, Nevada, also was a college football broadcaster for ABC for many, many years, was a co-owner of a restaurant in Oakland, California for a long, long time. And it should be noted that his son, his grandson, Tucker Jensen, pitched in two College World Series for Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Here's some irony. Embry-Riddle is a flight school. So Jackie Jensen's grandson starred in the flight school's baseball program. And Tucker Jensen also pitched in the Blue Jays organization back in 2011 and 2012. Now, Jackie Jensen passed away at a relatively young age, too, due to an apparent heart attack in Virginia back in July of 1982. So some very interesting stories of some of the lesser known names. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but some of the names that don't quite stand out, quite like a Duke Snyder or Roberto Clemente or Jackie Robinson in this set. So a lot of fun things from this TCMA set. Again, a set I was introduced to by a vending machine many, many years ago and got looped back into just with a little bargain bin hunting at a recent card show. And I'm glad that I found these cards. They're beautiful cards. And they will probably help grow my Renata Galasso sets. I'll be on the lookout for some of the cards from later sets from the late 70s that feature players from the early 20th century. That'll be a fun look at. What will also be fun, our next podcast. Again, coming 2 weeks from today. That'll be Friday, May 24th via Audio Boom and all of our various channels. So make sure you keep an eye out for that. Also, keep the comments coming at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, and you can make a donation to Wax Ecstatic to keep the program nice and strong, not only the maintenance of our website and RSS feeds and archive, but also in purchasing the products that we talk about here on the program. You can do that at paypal.me/waxecstatic. My thanks again to Mike Ehrenstein, the MA of TCMA, for joining us, for talking about the Renato Collasso set, as well as his induction into the hobby and the business side of it many, many years ago. And as I've promised, I will do my best to have Mike back on again to talk about some more of the TCMA sets, the minor league cards that he and Tom Collier created, basically building a whole new industry in the mid-70s there. And also his role, if you will, in the beginning days of Donruss in 1981 as the exclusive distributor of Donruss in New York City back in the early 80s. So that's going to be coming up on a future episode, and I hope you're there to join us. Make sure you spread the word, and if you follow us on a platform such as iTunes that allows for rating of a show and commentary, please do, with the honesty of your heart, give us a good rating, give us some nice comments, and spread the word about Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic, and we'll see you next time.